Nice. Sweet. Awesome. Cheers. See ya. Bye.
Welcome to another episode of Discover ADN, a podcast featuring conversations with people from all over the world. In this second season of the show, we'll talk to some wonderful people and hear their stories on what inspires them, what decisions have changed their careers, and what relationships have influenced their work. Today, I have the privilege of talking to Tomas Mahaliana, a man who calls Australia his home and is about to undergo a change like nobody else on this show. He's been a medical doctor for about 9 years, and I'll let him explain the rest. So, on that note, welcome to the show, Tomas.
Hi there. How are you going?
I'm doing pretty good, thank you. Let's get started with, of course, the very first question. What change are you about to go through?
Well, the facetious answer would be to say that I'm about to sit an exam for physician training, but the change that we're referring to is basically that in a couple of weeks from now, I'll be off to see the endocrinologist about the first steps of basically sex change.
And what does that involve?
So basically, sex change can mean quite a number of things. I sort of try and break it down now into four different categories. You know, a lot of people kind of assume that it's just this binary journey from, you know, for me, female to male or male to female, but it actually requires quite a different number of steps in different areas. And people choose to do some or sometimes none. So I think in some ways, the biggest thing is probably the social side of things. So presenting differently in society. So that's social transition. You've got legal transition, which is things like putting in the paperwork to change your sex on official documentation. There's the medical side of transition, and that usually involves hormone therapy of a variety of different forms. And finally, there's the surgical side of things, which can involve for people a number of different surgical options and types of operation.
That's quite a bit of work.
Yeah, tell me about it. it's at times quite overwhelming thinking about all of those steps and which ones I'm going to take and which ones I can't be bothered with.
All right. Well, before we get too deep, I'm going to be right up front. I'm coming at this from a position of complete ignorance. I've spoken to a lot of people about different kinds of change throughout life, but usually that's job change or like relationship change, things of that sort. You're about to undergo something very different. So if I ask any stupid questions, please forgive me.
Oh, absolutely. Oh, well, I'll put it this way. There's not very much, or there's more information now on the internet than there was, but back when I was going through puberty, there was very little information out there, and there's no such thing as a stupid question. So, I mean, a lot of these questions are things that I didn't know about a couple of years ago and now know a lot more about, and some of them I still don't know that much about, so feel free.
All right. Well, since you've just mentioned puberty, when was it that you discovered that you were male?
So, I mean, I always assumed it as a child, I guess. I mean, I remember being three and just assuming, you know, that I'm just a boy. But it really was, I mean, and my parents, you know, just, you know, they weren't particularly focused on the pink and the blue and the girls' toys and the boys' toys and that sort of thing. I mean, I occasionally had to wear a dress, which I absolutely hated. But, you know, they were pretty flexible. So it was really people outside my family, I guess, realizing that they perceived me as female. So I guess in a way it's kind of inverted. I always assumed that I was who I was, and it was really that I discovered that I was, in fact, I guess, perceived as female or in a female body.
So how would you define gender?
Gender is an interesting concept. The bottom line is that science really hasn't you know, explained why people feel a particular gender. I think the first distinction to make is the distinction between gender and sex. Sex is a biological state of being, and that in itself is very complicated. It goes all the way from, you know, what genitalia do you have, what chromosomes do you have, what's your hormonal status. It's you know, and also secondary sexual characteristics like boobs and body hair and that sort of thing. So you've got sex, which is kind of this biological phenomenon and is quite complicated and also has various permutations. And then on the other hand, you have gender, which is the way you feel you are. And, you know, for most people, that kind of matches up reasonably well, even if it's not a complete one-to-one kind of perfect match. You know, most people feel that they are who their birth certificate says they are. For reasons that are as yet unknown, some people's feeling of who they are in terms of their gender doesn't correspond well with their biological sex. Some people have a fixed gender identity. So for example, I pretty much always feel male. But some people actually have an in-between or fluid identity. Some people, you know, go from feeling male some days to feeling female some days, and that would be, I guess, considered bigender or gender fluid. And some people don't really even identify strongly with any gender. But as to why this is, there are theories, but none of them have really been able to be proven one way or another. A lot of people say, well, gender is a completely social construct, but probably the historical example that kind of proves that that's not really true is a very sad case. It's a sad case of a young boy who several decades ago underwent routine circumcision surgery, or what was meant to be a routine circumcision surgery, and ended up having a major injury to his penis as an infant. He, at that time, if that sort of thing happened, when it rarely occurred, those boys were all reassigned to be female and given female hormones at puberty. So he was raised as a girl, dressed as a girl, you know, underwent hormone replacement at puberty, you know, had his testes removed, and he always felt male. Later in life, he found out what the case was, you know, what his surgical history was, and he chose to go through the process of having been in society female, being male in society and taking hormones and things. I think the sad thing, though, is that he ended up with some pretty major depressive symptoms as a result of all of this and eventually committed suicide, which is extremely sad. However, there are other cases in the literature where people were reassigned and actually their new identity just stuck and they never felt abnormal. So why this happens in some people and not others, no one really knows.
All right. Do you think that gender and sexuality are linked?
That is a difficult question to answer in a lot of ways. I think the bottom line is they probably are linked in some way, but you can consider them as different, you know, different continuums. So someone can be a trans guy and be straight like me, so I'm attracted to women, but someone could be a trans guy and be attracted to men or bisexual. So they're kind of different spectrums in a way. But as to how the split is in terms of sexual orientation, that's sort of a little bit up in the air at the moment. There's some literature to suggest, for whatever reason, that in the group of female to male transgender people or trans men, that about half of them are gay. I don't know why that is, and I don't think anyone else does either.
All right. Which gender do you find more attractive?
Growing up, I never, like, I had a lot of difficulty answering this question for myself. I was definitely, like, I kind of had sort of absorbed the idea that I was female and going to, you know, grow up and get married to some guy, et cetera, and, you know, obviously things didn't really turn out that way. Around puberty, it became quite obvious that even though I'd had a couple of crushes on guy friends, that I was really mainly into women. But I did have relationships with guys, and it took me a while to kind of sort out how I felt. And now, I guess, having addressed my gender identity, I've come to realize that really I am only attracted to women. I admire men, and, you know, there's many very good-looking guys, really cool guys, guys I click with, but I'm just not romantically or sexually interested in them.
Can you tell us what has been the hardest part of being the opposite physical gender?
So I guess the hardest part about, you know, having a female biological sex but having a male gender is the disconnect between the social side of things for me. I mean, everyone's a little bit different. Certainly when I was growing up, the only way to be trans was seemingly to really feel very, very uncomfortable about your body. And I do feel a little bit uncomfortable about my body, but the main thing is being treated as female when I'm not female. I went to a single-sex all-girls school in high school, which was a public school, which is quite common in New Zealand, and I just felt really uncomfortable. And similarly, I feel uncomfortable in 100% female-only spaces. You know, like at uni, if I went to the women's room because I came out as a lesbian, or, you know, the women's bathrooms are an example as well. Like, it's always been an uncomfortable sort of thing for me to be kind of regarded as female, only surrounded by females, that sort of thing. But in particular, I think in some ways, sexism that I've been subjected to as a woman in inverted commas has also been quite painful as well. For the dual reasons that it's completely unfair anyway, and I would stick up for any woman's right to be treated the same, but also because it's kind of going, well, you're a woman and you're less. So I think the social side of things and being regarded in society as female and having a set of subcultural notions associated to that, that's been the hardest part, I think.
How has your family responded to the news?
So it's, once again, a bit of a difficult question. So, difficult situation. So I've told my parents, and my mum has just been a mum, I guess. She's worried. You know, she's worried that I'm not going to meet anyone. She's worried that people will discriminate against me. She's worried about the physical side effects of any medical or surgical treatment that I may take. I got my mum to tell my dad, and apparently he was okay with it, but worried about the same things, which I guess are things that are natural to worry about. I mean, I'm worried about those things too. So, in that sense, they were terrible when I came out as gay, but they've also had 15 years in the meantime to get adjusted to the idea of sexual minorities, and my mum's had some transgendered patients. So their views have come a long way. That said, I think that they'd probably prefer that I don't go through the whole thing, but, you know, that's kind of... They've also said, well, if you do choose to go through it, then, you know, we're going to have to support you through it, and we're happy to support you through it. So I guess we'll wait and see. There's a lot of people who say that they're supportive on paper and get a bit funny about things. But, you know, that side of things is kind of manageable and okay, and, you know, I'll tell them what I want to tell them. But another issue which that comes up is that most of my extended family are in Sri Lanka. So Sri Lanka is a country that is very conservative when it comes to sexual minorities. Funnily enough, it's actually not that sexist when it comes to things like work. You know, my mum's a doctor, my grandmother was a high school principal, and so was her mother. So, you know, there's a long history of of gender equality. However, when it comes to homosexuality, that is illegal and it can be punished by up to a 10-year prison sentence. There really is no concept of transgender people in Sri Lankan culture at all, which is it stands in contrast to India, which, while it has a lot of problems with sexism, there is a third gender in Indian culture. The homosexuality, I think, was decriminalized and then recriminalized, but there were moves towards decriminalization of homosexuality in India. So it's interesting seeing how those two countries are different. So when it comes to conceptualizing that kind of difference, my extended family, unfortunately, are just not going to get it. There's no concept in the culture of that, and that makes things very difficult, especially when it's something that's illegal in the country.
I really struggle to understand the logic of putting someone in jail for being, I don't know how else to say it, non-hetero.
Yeah, well, I mean, you could kind of joke that, well, so this person's attracted to the same sex, so you're just putting them in a place where they're only surrounded by the same sex. It's a bit strange. Yeah, it is. Look, it's bizarre to me as well. I just don't understand why it should have anything to do with the state whatsoever, as long as it's a consensual act. Apparently, the law is very rarely prosecuted, but the people who face discrimination there's social discrimination, but the people who would get prosecuted and chucked in jail would probably be the kind of people who are political enemies, and that's leverage. So I guess another example would be someone like Anwar Ibrahim in Malaysia, where they just use that as an excuse to put him in prison. You know, whether or not he's gay is almost a side issue, which is really quite strange. I suppose in some cultures the idea of social order and, you know, what you do is to get married and have babies and move out and all of that sort of thing, like it's very preset and predetermined. So you have a lot more individual choice outside Sri Lanka. So I think in that way I'm quite grateful to be living here.
Yeah, that is definitely a benefit. That being said, you are surrounded by very educated people.
Mm.
Your colleagues are doctors and nurses. How have they responded to your gender, to your sexuality?
So it's kind of a two-pronged thing. When it comes to, so I was really scared actually about coming out, and the reason is because I've just heard so many unbelievably bigoted statements from my colleagues over the years. And, you know, Caitlyn Jenner came out this year and, you know, that was a huge talking point. And, you know, one of Angelina Jolie's kids is transgendered and that's another big issue. And people have a lot to say and very little knowledge. you know, they say some incredibly nasty things. So I was very scared about coming out. But I was lucky. I am lucky, though. My colleagues are health workers. Even if some of them are going to be loud and rude and abrasive about things behind people's backs, they do have some sort of structure to which they can kind of fit the idea into, if that makes sense. I work for a public government organization, you know, a hospital, so there's very clear directives about discrimination. People are scared of coming up against that thing and complaints being made. But the other thing is that I've been very lucky to have an incredibly supportive set of people around me as well. My bosses have all been fantastic, and they've been very clear that if anyone were to kind of be discriminatory, that they would want to know and address the issue. They've helped me a lot with that, and they've made me feel very comfortable. And You know, by far and large, most of the people have responded either positively or they haven't said anything. So, look, that's, I think, been pretty good. One difficulty has been that, you know, when it comes to changing my name, I have to undergo a legal name change to use my new name in the hospital. And that's kind of an issue that also affects women who get married. So that's a very high level issue that's pretty annoying. But you know, it is what it is.
It is indeed, and I'm glad to hear that your colleagues are not giving you a hard time about this. That's something that would not be acceptable. Let me ask you a little bit about the physical changes. So is there anything about getting a sex change that terrifies you or keeps you up at night?
Oh, look, all of it in bits and pieces. So probably the thing that I was really the most worried about, and it's kind of faded a little bit now, is that now as a doctor, you know, you just get scared of everything, I think. You know, healthcare workers tend to be hypochondriacs, decline surgery more, et cetera, et cetera. So around the time that I came out last year for the first time, a big study, a big observational study, I think it was, came out about the medical effects of supplemental testosterone and androgens in men with low testosterone levels, so men with what we call hypogonadism. And that seemed to suggest that there was a modest increase in the risk of cardiovascular disease, so heart attacks, strokes, and other metabolic side effects as well. Now, at the time, that was pretty intense because I've had several family members die of, you know, diabetic complications, heart disease, strokes. We just have a very strong family history. And granted, those guys, you know, my uncles just don't take care of themselves either, and they smoke and eat crap. But, you know, that was probably the most worrying thing, you know, thinking, is my choice going to be dying young of a medical complication or living a life that is utterly miserable? So that was probably the biggest thing that kept me awake at night, along with how are people going to react. You know, I felt much better after I talked to, you know, told my parents, even though they're a bit funny about some aspects of things. I mean, I was just relieved that they were pretty good about it. So those are the two biggest things, the effects of hormone therapy, whether that's actually going to cause medical problems, and the social side of things. And, I mean, you know, the legal stuff is really just, I hate paperwork. I can't stand paperwork. And there is a lot of paperwork. Now, just to follow up on that, I think the good news is that further trials have shown no effect when it comes to cardiovascular risk. So that's been a huge relief as well. And that's, I guess, another thing that swung my decision.
Will you have the operations there in Australia, or will you go to another country such as Thailand?
Aha. So I guess I, at this point, have put surgery off the table for a number of reasons. So I'll just quickly explain that there's about the different operations that are available. So some people, so for transgendered men, probably the most common operation that people have is having what's called a chest reconstruction surgery or TOP surgery. That refers to having a bilateral mastectomy and a chest reconstruction in terms of making sure that it's got a suitable aesthetic appearance. And, you know, some people, you know, they try and preserve the nipples, that sort of thing. So that's TOP surgery for a transgendered man. So for a transgendered woman, that would some people do choose to have breast augmentation surgery. Some choose actually not to. then you've got what's called bottom surgery, or surgery on, your gonads and other reproductive organs. So for transgendered men, there's a variety of things. So hysterectomy, removal of the uterus, because, you know, people often find having their period very kind of confronting and uncomfortable. And, you know, they may actually have other medical conditions that cause them to bleed a lot. There's removal of the ovaries. So you can have one or the other or both, and that's usually done at the same time if you choose to do that. And then there's also surgery on one's external genitalia. And even within that, there's a variety of options. You know, some are about mobilizing the clitoris to make it larger and function like a penis. And then there's other operations to actually construct a more functional penis. For transgendered women, in terms of bottom surgery, so there's removal of the penis, removal of the testes, but usually that's also combined with formation of the new vagina and other external genitalia that fit with the female sex. It's quite a few different options, of which, sorry?
I was just wondering, where do these body parts come from?
So in terms of reconstructing in terms of making a penis, for example, the technique is to do what's called a flap operation. So they take muscle, skin, and nerves and blood vessels, that like a chunk of tissue basically from one part of the body, and then graft it. You can take some skin actually from the lower part of the abdomen and rotate it around to kind of do that. And also I think they mobilize various areas as well. So pretty complicated and tricky surgery. Usually they take some tissue from actually the forearm to do that, because of the anatomy is quite good for that. And then when it comes to transgendered women and the operation choices, the common things tend to be either just reconstructing a cavity, like when it comes to the vaginal side of things, reconstructing a cavity and then lining it with skin, usually I think it's with a skin graft, but you can also use a short section of bowel to also to construct something. I have to admit though that some of these details I may not get right, so I apologize in advance if I haven't quite represented that area of things perfectly accurately. But yeah, it's I guess for me, I don't really want to have genital surgery at all. Like, it's not really something I'm interested in that in this stage. And then when it comes to top surgery, I don't know. I'm going to reevaluate in a year's time and see where I'm at, and see whether it's something that I want to do, or, you know, whether or not it's necessary for me. I'm not huge on surgery because I'm a doctor and I see all the risks and none of the benefits in my head. But that, you know, it's different for everyone, and a lot of people do have surgery. So as to where I would have it done if I were to have something done, most guys do tend to have surgery locally within Australia. So that involves taking out a private insurance policy, because it's really not done in the public sector here. Then getting part of it funded by the private health fund, part of it you do get some money back from Medicare, and then the rest you self-fund. And then, you had to pay for the anaesthetist, the surgeon, and the hospital. So most people are out of pocket several thousand dollars. In terms of overseas options, you can, I think, get it done cheaper overseas, but I don't know that it's that much cheaper if you do choose to go overseas. Quite a few people actually come from New Zealand to have their operations in Australia due to greater access. And when it comes to bottom surgery, I guess, I mean, a hysterectomy, usually reasonably straightforward, getting that done here, but it'd have to be in the private system. When it comes to, you know, complex external genitalia surgery, you know, making a new penis, that sort of surgery, unfortunately, isn't very available in Australia. So my understanding is that people tend to go to the UK or US. There were some surgeons doing it locally, but look, I'm really not sure whether any of them are doing that operation anymore. And the general consensus from what the guys have been saying online is that there probably isn't an option to get that surgery done in Australia. I mean, if you can get stuff done locally, that's great. You know, you can follow up with your surgeon, which is also a big advantage. But a lot of transgender women go to Thailand because they've got such a large amount of surgical expertise there. The surgeons are supposed to be very good, and they do a lot of operating. And the other thing is that it is cheaper, significantly cheaper.
Wow.
Yeah, so it is a big topic. So for me, if I do choose to have an operation, probably have it done locally.
Okay. Yeah, that clears up something I've always wondered. Again, pardon my ignorance, but I figured that if somebody wanted to change sex, they would need to wait for someone else of the opposite sex to also want to change. And then, assuming that their bodies were compatible, and again, this is very stupid, but I assume they would just change body parts so long as their bodies wouldn't reject these parts too much. But it's very interesting that we can take parts of our own body and change them so drastically.
Yeah. Well, it's interesting you bring up the whole transplantation thing because, as I think quite a few people would probably be aware of, a few months ago they did the first womb transplant. And I think it was within a family. Like, I think it was the mum donated her uterus to her daughter. So that she could have children. It was quite successful, and I think they removed it afterwards from recollection. So, there is stuff that's clearly in the works, and I do wonder, are we going to go down that route? Because, it wasn't all that long ago that there were organs that we thought were never able to be transplanted. I mean, now you've got arms, legs, face. 20 years ago, that was thought to be, surgically, medically impossible. And I guess, really down the track, way into the future, maybe in 30, 40 years' time, the standard of care will be to grow something new, to 3D print a new organ, wait for it to grow, and then graft that on. And then you've kind of got something that's genetically yours and that you're not going to reject. And, maybe gives you a much better functional outcome than we can do right now because there's all those worries, are you going to lose sensation if you have surgery, what kind of surgical complications are you going to have? And maybe we'll be able to circumvent all of that. The functional results are very variable, I think, but they're improving day by day with the procedures as people get more and more familiar with them. But, down the track, who knows? It's pretty exciting to think about for a number of reasons.
Yeah, that is going to give me a bit to think about.
Yeah, no worries.
But let me move on to the next question. I don't want people to just hear dead air while I'm thinking. If you were to have your breasts removed, would that reduce the chance of breast cancer in the future? Would there be any medical benefit to doing so?
Remove the breasts. Yeah, your chance of getting a breast cancer would diminish quite dramatically. Obviously the same thing applies to having your ovaries or uterus removed. That means that you can't, you can still get cervical cancer, I think, and you still need to have pap smears because even if the cervix is gone, you can get upper vaginal cancers due to HPV. But your cancer risk obviously drops quite significantly. And some people have chosen to do that for that reason. The evidence is really only very slow to come through because you've got such small numbers of people being studied and observational studies when it comes to transgender medicine. But there was this observation that perhaps testosterone increased the risk of getting an ovarian or uterus cancer. And for a long time, the advice was to try and get everyone to have a hysterectomy and have their ovaries removed, but that is now debatable. Over time we learn more and more about things like the medical side effects and things, and we sometimes find some really unexpected things. So it's looking at the medicine as a doctor as well as a as well as someone who this is going to affect personally has been very interesting.
Okay. Well, let me ask something a little different from the medical aspect. I'm wondering how instinct is playing a role in this. Because as far as I know, most humans want to procreate. But if you undergo a sex change, will you still want to procreate? B, will you be able to procreate? How is that going to work?
People do a variety of things. Some guys keep the uterus and ovaries or get preserve eggs and that side of things. As a lot of people would be aware of, there was a very high-profile example of a guy who did go through pregnancy that was on the cover of Time and kind of had clickbait headlines of male pregnancy. But it's actually not that uncommon. So what people do is they go off testosterone for a little while, conceive, and then go on to have a baby quite naturally, I guess, but with plus or minus assisted reproductive technologies. For me, I'm not all that fussed. Or I should say I don't really want to go through pregnancy. I'm not super keen on – I'm not that attached to the idea of biological reproduction. So for me, I'd probably prefer a partner in the future – she wanted to carry a child, that we do it that way, or to adopt. I really don't care that much about biological children. I would like to have kids, but for me it's not the biggest thing that I'm worried about or the biggest priority in my life right now. But down the track I'd like to be a dad. I hope that answers the question.
I think that does answer the question, yes. It was just something that I really have no understanding of, so I was very curious about. Let me ask you this other question, because you know far better than I do that a lot of people do not agree with sex change. So, aside from smacking them upside the head and saying, mind your own business, what would you say to these people to educate them a little bit or to allow others to make their own decisions?
I think there's a number of ways. I think there are a number of facts that when people are exposed to, they start thinking a little bit more. I think one thing is people who have the ick factor and they're like, ew. Those people need to meet someone or see someone on TV and, maybe try and see that, there are human beings behind this idea that they have and they demonize. I think that's one thing. I think there's a bunch of people who think that, you know, the whole transgender thing is just made up. And I think I'd like to point them to the scientific and medical research that shows that pre-transition and prior to people being who they want to be, whatever transition means for them, the suicide rate and the mental health statistics are appalling. You know, suicide attempt rates of things like 50% or whatever, you know, ridiculously high. And then people transition, you know, socially or medically, whatever. But they are the people that they have always been and are more free about that and open about that. Their suicide rate drops dramatically to like less than 10%. So we've got really good evidence that the outcomes from being who you want to be or being who you are already are just very good. So I think, you know, I'd just say to them, well, why do you want these people to have a high risk of mental health problems when there is quite clearly something that is going to make people happier? I mean, why would you wish that upon anyone? So that's another thing. And then I try and draw analogies sometimes. It's kind of like, you know, one of my friends, I kind of said, well, just imagine that you woke up one day and you're a kid and, you know what your name is and you try and tell everyone what your name is and they all just kind of cut you off and just intentionally call you the wrong name all the time or the wrong gender all the time. That gives people a bit of pause. They go, yeah, that wouldn't be very nice. I wouldn't want to go through that. And that, I think, starts to make people think about things. And, yeah, like I said, I do sometimes bring up the stories of, well, you know, if it's this made-up thing that you think is really gross, then, you know, what about those kids who had their, you know, gender their biological sex reassigned without their knowledge? I mean, what about those people? If gender is totally social, then why did they have problems? So that's kind of the message I'd like to give to them, is to maybe think outside the square, maybe expose yourself to different ways of thinking. I think there's always going to be some people who've just got very, very fixed ideas who will never want to change the way that they think. Sometimes being exposed to reality is the only thing that gets through to those people. So I think some of it is going to have to be society just taking time to register a concept. I mean, we have so much evidence to say that in almost every culture that there is a concept of third gender or, you know, people who don't fit neatly into the gender boundaries. Even in Western society, we have historical people who, you know, went about their life in the gender that they were that was different to their biological sex. We have that recorded in history for centuries or millennia. So there's a lot of good counter arguments, which is good. And then, you know, some people just probably need to grow up a little bit.
Well, growing up is important, yeah. Yes. And I like that thought experiment that you had. So let me ask you this one last question, sure, before we wrap up. What advice would you give someone who might be confused about their sex or gender in general?
I think the advice that I would give them is to not just ignore it. I mean, you could come to any number of conclusions at the end of exploring things, but you know, I think a really good step that I made was going to counselling and seeing a psychologist. It is necessary in Australia to do those things before you consider endocrine treatment, for example, hormones. But that aside, I thought that was the best thing I did, was going and talking to someone professional about it. Clearly, access to that varies from country to country. Within Australia, you can actually find the Australian Psychological Society allows you to search by areas of interest. So people who are interested in gender, who are psychologists, can find quite easily. In other countries, I think there are similar things, but word of mouth is another thing. And I guess the other thing is that sometimes it's helpful to there are some quite good Facebook groups and other social groups that can be helpful. Then there's organisations such as the Gender Centre in New South Wales, where I live. They have a lot of resources. And then there's websites as well that are now really very good. So I might give you some of those links and... there are a number of really good websites and YouTube videos and things where people talk about their own experiences and debunk some of the myths around gender identity. So look, there are resources out there. So I would say definitely jump on the internet and have a look around. Go and find a sympathetic professional to talk to, because it's just good. And reach out to people in the community, and I'm very happy to take questions and to be contacted as well if anyone's struggling with that sort of thing, to just have a chat.
Well, this leads perfectly into the next question. How can people get in touch with you?
That's a good question. So I think probably send me an email. That's probably the best idea. So that's Dr. Thomas M. So drtomasm at gmail.com. So I'll say that again. drtomasm at gmail.com.
All right, and I'll have the in the show notes as well for anybody who would like to send you a message. Are you also on the social networks, or would you rather keep this kind of talk via email?
I think that's a good question. Email's probably the best, I think.
Well, it's certainly more private.
Yes, it is. I think sometimes it works works best, and then I can always send people other social media links and stuff where I'm online, chat, etc.
Well, this brings us to the end of the show, and Dr. Mahalyana, I would really like to thank you for coming on and answering many of my questions.
No worries.
I learned quite a bit.
Yeah. I was going to say thank you as well, because I've always I have wanted to do something like this for some time, answering questions. I think hopefully it helps everyone else out, and so thank you for having me as well.
And thank you for giving me a lot to think about. So again, I'm going to have all of the links from this episode in the show notes for anybody who would like to get in touch with you. And yeah, I encourage anybody who has questions about this subject to do just that.
Cool.